My wife asked me this morning, she said, what are you speaking on today? And I said, the validity of the New Testament Gospels. And she said, later, she came to me, she said, you know, if I was searching on the website and looking for a sermon and I saw that title, I would go, and just move on to the next one. And I said, it's not a sexy topic. It's not, some people enjoy it, others, you know, not so much. I hope it'll be enjoyable for you. Certainly was interesting putting together some of this information here. So I hope I can keep you awake. Everyone had your coffee this morning, I hope. We've got some 5-hour energy if you need it, right over here. Well, I'd like to begin with the question today, are the New Testament Gospels reliable? That's the central focus I want to revolve my sermon around today. And specifically, really the question is, are the eyewitness accounts of the writers credible and reliable? Now, this is a rather large subject, I know, a very big subject. And really, I can only scratch the surface of what has been researched on this, what kind of stuff has been done on this. There are, frankly, men and some women who have devoted their entire lives to the subjects. Bruce Metzger, I think, who was a great New Testament textual critic, devoted his entire life to studying the New Testament scriptures. I came across something that was interesting to me. I don't know if anybody's familiar with, well, I think it was A.A. Robertson. I believe isn't he the one who did the harmony? Is that him? I think he was the one that put the harmony of the Gospels together. And he, of course, was one of the great scholars. And there was a letter that I found that Bruce Metzger had written to him when he was 19 and said he wanted to become a Greek scholar and he wanted to study under A.A. Robertson. And I guess when he finally got out of the school where he was at and he went to study under him, A.A. Robertson had died, I think, that previous year, so he wasn't able to study under him. Bruce Metzger just died, I think, in 2007, I believe, and he was 93. So this goes back a long way. People have been studying textual criticism and the historicity and reliability of the New Testament scriptures for years. Like I say, devoting their entire lives. But I think that what God has done is God has given us these men to study these subjects for us, to learn about these things, so that we can have a deeper appreciation, a deeper understanding of the Bible and its historical and its textual accuracy. I think it's interesting that you could go back maybe 100 years or so, and in this country you would have a great number of people, much larger than today, who believe in the historicity of the Bible. They believe the validity of the scriptures. They did more so than today, even though they didn't have as much information as we have today. So much more abounds. So you see the technology of culture, the way that the world is going, that it steals the faith away from people. And so what I'm hoping, if anything this does for any of us, is that it strengthens our faith, that it encourages us to know that the things that we believe, they're true and they're accurate. I've sometime thought about putting together a series on the reliability of the gospel of the New Testament scriptures, and I may sometime in the future, but really, I just want to give you a short introduction on the background to the manuscripts of the New Testament. And then I want to create an apologetic, that is an answer back to critics for some of the criticisms of the New Testament in regards to its origins. Now, as you're all well aware, the Bible is one book, but it's a collection of books. It's a collection of many books. In the Old Testament, the oldest part, we have 39 books that makes up the Old Testament, and then 27 that make up the New Testament. And this entire collection of books was written over approximately a 1600-year time span by more than 40 authors. And these people came from all different kinds of backgrounds. We have kings, we have diplomats, we have poor people, we have fishermen, we have tent makers. We have, for instance, like the prophet Amos. He was a very poor man who had a very lowly job in society. He was a sycamore fig tree tender or keeper. He was a caretaker. And so we have a great cross-section of people that have written these scriptures throughout history. Now, the Bible was originally written in three languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and it was written on three continents, Asia, Africa, and Europe. And really, this speaks to the idea that Christianity is not just simply some Western religion. It speaks against that idea, I should say. It's not just simply some Western religion that's a product of one culture that has been used for cultural imperialism. No, the Bible is really its greatest apologetic. It's its greatest answer against that kind of onslaught. The Bible's social, geographical, and culture is, in its original context, was then quickly multiplied. They made copies, made lots of copies of the New Testament and manuscripts. And in particular, they were copied very quickly in the first and the second centuries, and they were translated into multiple languages, and they were spread across the known world. Now, what this means is that when we come to today and we ask the question, what is the Bible and what is the New Testament and is it reliable? We have thousands upon thousands of manuscripts and documents on which we base our text. Now, the integrity of any writing is determined by a number of things, but there are really two important things, I think, that determine its accuracy or its integrity. First is the number of the documented manuscripts or the fragments of manuscripts that we have. So how many manuscripts or fragments do we have? And the second is the time-distance relationship from between when that manuscript was written to when the events or to the events that it records. So if there's a large time gap distance, for instance, between a manuscript and the history that it says it writes about, it's going to be generally less trustworthy than if it's very close to the events that are recorded. Now, that is a generality. I know there are caveats to this. We know that the Scripture says that all inspiration is given by God, that all Scripture is given by God through inspiration, and that the Holy Spirit brings back to remembrance certain things. So we understand that God has transmitted these things for us, that they are inspired. But in general, when you look at textual criticism, these are some of the things that you will look at: time, distance, relationships. So how do these two questions, how do the New Testament manuscripts compare to other ancient manuscripts? How does the New Testament compare to other things in relation to these two questions? Well, if we look at the works of ancient philosopher Plato, for example, Plato, his works have seven existing copies of ancient manuscripts, and they can be studied and they can be compared in order to determine the accuracy and the quality of the transmission of his writings throughout the years. The oldest of these manuscripts is a copy dating about 1400 years after the original work that Plato had written. And even today, that Plato, his works are read and they're well respected. Now, when it comes to the Bible, there are over 5,600 handwritten New Testament manuscripts in the Greek language alone that help us to ensure the accuracy of its writings. And many of the earliest copies are separated from the originals, not by 1,400 years like Plato. No, not 1,400 years, by 25 to 50 years, by only 25 to 50 years. In addition to the 5,600 known Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, you can add about 10,000 Latin manuscripts and about 9,300 early portions of the New Testament. And then we have a total of about 20 to maybe 24,000 different manuscripts or fragments or portions of the New Testament. There is simply no other document in history, no other document from antiquity that is as well documented as the New Testament. Nothing even closely approaches this number. The nearest number of manuscripts that comes even close is Homer's Iliad, and it has 634 manuscripts. Compare that to 24,000 or so. The first complete text of Homer dates to about 13th century AD. Now, there are some earlier fragments, but the first complete work is some several centuries afterwards, even more than a millennia. The scholar John Warwick Montgomery wrote this. He said, to be skeptical of the resultant text of the New Testament books is to allow all of classical antiquity to slip into obscurity, for no documents of the ancient world is well attested bibliographically as the New Testament. F.F. Bruce, another scholar, he's a textual critic of the New Testament, he writes this. He said, there's no body of ancient literature in the world which enjoys such a wealth of good textual attestation as the New Testament. In fact, in his book, The Bible and Archaeology, a man called Sir Frederick G. Kenyon, he's a former director and principal librarian of the British Museum, stated this about the New Testament. He said, the interval between the dates of original composition and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as if to be, in fact, negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. End quote. There are some good examples of ancient New Testament manuscripts. This is complete manuscripts. For instance, there's the Codex Vaticanus and there's the Codex Sinaiticus, which are parchment copies. Parchments came a little bit later than papyri, but parchment copies of the entire New Testament, and they date to about the 4th century A.D. Now, we don't base our text on these two manuscripts. We go off of the Textus Receptus, the majority text, and there's a lot of evidence that that should be the case. We have slivers and partial manuscripts of this even before these particular ones were completed. But again, even before these two complete documents were put together in the 4th century, we still have fragments and papyri of portions of the New Testament dating from the 100 to 200 years before Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, well before this one was even completed. The very oldest portion of the Bible surviving today is a fragment of papyrus codex containing John chapter 18, verse 31 to 33, and verse 37. John chapter 18, verse 31 to 33 and verse 37 is the oldest document we have today that we know of. And it's called the Rylands Papyrus P52. And a lot of people just call it P52. P52 is very famous. And it dates from about 130 AD. And it was found in Egypt. And frankly, what it did was it caused academia to place the fourth gospel, this gospel of John, back into the 1st century. Abandoning this 19th century assertion that it could not have been written by the Apostle John. We also have quotations from the New Testament in the writings of what are called the Church Fathers, the early Church Fathers. They point to the relatively early completion of the New Testament. Now, German scholarship of the 19th and 20th centuries argued for the New Testament to be written a couple hundred years after the events were recorded. And this led many people to begin distrusting the content of the New Testament, believing that it was simply made up by the church in order to somehow rewrite history. But the discovery of early fragments of the New Testament and the writings of the church fathers provide us really with a good evidence that there was a very short time lapse between the events that occurred and the writings that occurred in the Gospels. For example, the Epistle of Clement to the Corinthians. It was that particular document was dated AD 95. So this was even before we hit 100. But it cites verses from the Gospels. It cites verses from Acts, from Romans, 1 Corinthians, Ephesians, Titus, Hebrews, and 1 Peter. We also have the letter of Ignatius dated 115 AD. And they were written to several churches in Asia Minor, and they cite that particular one cites verses from Matthew, John, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, 1st and 2nd Timothy, and Titus. And these letters indicate that the entire New Testament was written within the 1st century AD. There is other internal evidence for a 1st century date as well, for the writings of the New Testament. The book of Acts, for instance, ends abruptly with Paul in prison, who was awaiting his trial. That's one of the last things that we see in the book of Acts. And it's likely that Luke wrote Acts during this time before Paul had finally appeared before Caesar. And this would be around 62 to 63 AD, meaning that Acts and Luke's gospel were written within about 30 years of the ministry of and the death of Jesus Christ. There is further evidence of this, and for instance, one of the things that we look at is there's no mention of the destruction of the temple We don't see that anywhere listed, that the temple had been destroyed in 70 AD in the Gospels. We see, though, that Matthew, Mark, Luke record Jesus' prophecy that the temple would be destroyed. He tells us that it would be within that next generation, but no New Testament book actually refers to those events having actually been occurring or happening. So it's likely that the letters, most of them were written possibly before 70 AD, before this particular event had happened. I think we probably wouldn't say that about Revelation. Some of the letters that John had written, he wrote them later. In addition to the annual or the actual Greek manuscripts, there are more than 1,000 copies in fragments of the New Testament in Syrian, Coptic, Armenian, Gothic, and Ethiopic, as well as 8,000 copies of the Latin Vulgate, some of which date back almost to Jerome's original translation in AD 384 to 400. Now, I had mentioned before that there are quotations from the early church fathers about the New Testament, or about, we have multiple quotes from the New Testament writings. Well, this in of itself is a witness to an early date for the completed New Testament. How many quotations are there, though? How many quotations are there? Well, there was there's a scholar named Daniel Wallace, Daniel B. Wallace, I believe. You can look him up. Brilliant scholar out of Dallas Theological Seminary. He's a preeminent textual critic today, a defender of the Bible, and he says this. He says that there are more than 1 million quotes from the early church fathers out of the New Testament. That means that if all of the ancient New Testament manuscripts were somehow to disappear overnight, he says that it would still be possible to reconstruct the entire New Testament with the exception of about 20 verses, just from the quotations of these early church fathers. This is interesting. I was watching this debate between Daniel Wallace and this gentleman named Bart Ehrman. And this debate took place just about 2 years ago. It was on February 1st, 2012. And here we have Dan Wallace, who was debating Bart Ehrman. And Bart Ehrman is also a textual critic, just like Dan Wallace. And he studied under Bruce Metzger. So we have this lineage that sort of takes place from A.A. Robertson to Bruce Metzger to Bart Ehrman. Now, Ehrman once claimed himself to be a Christian. He is not anymore. He claims to be an atheist, based on his studies in the New Testament that drove him to that conclusion. But during this debate, and this is so, I'm telling you, this is why this debate was set up. Basically, a Bible believer versus a non-Bible believer, both textual critics. But during the debate, Dr. Wallace made the announcement. It was actually at this debate, first time this had been announced anywhere, that 6 more New Testament papyri had been found and discovered in a Turkish collection. And all of them are fragmentary, and one of them is placed in front of the date of P52, the earliest known fragment. This is from John. He says this one's even earlier. Now, remember, P52 is reported to be around approximately 130 from John's Gospel. But the most important find of the 6 papyrus is a fragment of Mark's Gospel, he says. Mark's Gospel, he says, actually claims it's from the first century. He puts it into the first century. Now, I've looked for some updates on this since I've seen that debate, and I can't find any. So I don't know what's come of this up to this point. Maybe Mr. Robinson knows something more current than I do. Maybe they're still working on it. Sometimes these things take several years to be able to research and to put together some sort of report on this to try and authenticate this. But this is staggering to think that we actually have some sort of fragment dating actually from the first century of the Bible. Now, what does all this mean? What does all this mean? This is sexy stuff. This is great. This is important. This is really important. This is amazing. What does it all mean, though? Well, that we have overwhelming evidence of early writings and copies of the New Testament. That we have this stuff. It means that we don't have some mythical time-distance relationship that the critics say that there is, from the time the Bible was written to the time the events actually occurred. And this really leaves no time for the legendary accumulation of stories to develop. You see, this is what Bart Ehrman had hung his hat on in this debate that I watched. He challenges the Christian. He challenges you and me, and he says this. He says, what do you suppose happened to the stories about Jesus over the years as they were told and retold, not as disinterested news stories reported by eyewitnesses, but as propaganda meant to convert people to faith, told by people who had themselves been told them fifth or sixth or 19th hand? Did your kids ever play the telephone game? End quote. Now, of course, you all know what the telephone game is. I'm sure everybody has played the telephone game at some point in their life. You take a room full of people, and this first person relates some detailed, interesting story to the second person, and then they relay that story to the third, and it keeps on going all the way down, one person telling the next with no intrusion from anyone else in that whole chain of people. And when you get to the end, and you've gone through, let's say, 20 different people, that story at the end usually doesn't resemble anything like the story at the beginning. It's usually completely different. Maybe something has been inserted to just completely change the character of the story. Maybe oftentimes what you will see is you will see the details of the story have not only been changed, but they've been reduced. They've been taken out. The story is much shorter than it was at the beginning because people can't remember the details as they're transmitted from one person to the next. And so in that short period of time, whatever it takes, 5 or 10 minutes, not years, but just minutes, this story changes dramatically from the beginning and to the end. Well, is the transmission of the New Testament like this game of telephone? Is that the way it works? Is that the way it happens? Bart Ehrman says it is. So how can we trust the New Testament? The difference between the telephone game, brethren, and the transmission of the New Testament are really many. First, when you come to the New Testament, there are multiple lines of transmission. Really, hundreds and even thousands of lines of transmission that go on. We don't have just one. We don't have just one person talking to the next, with nothing that comes in from the side. That's not the way that the Bible was transmitted. We have multiple witnesses, multiple accounts that they can draw, that we can draw on. And when we look at the New Testament, it's not as if we can only speak to the 20th person. We don't just ask that 20th person at the end of the line and say, well, what did he say? No, you can talk to various people. You can see what all of these people had said. We have multiple witnesses. In fact, this is one of the amazing things about the New Testament is the fact that we don't just have one document. If you have one document and that's all you have, then you can really challenge it. And you say, how do you know this is true? The fact that we have thousands upon thousands of documents and they are so closely fit together that there's so little variance in them actually establishes the validity of that document. What we have and what's the earliest copyists had were multiple witnesses. A textual critic doesn't just rely on the last person, but they can interrogate the scribes over the centuries. So the process really isn't meant to be just some silly game where one person decides to muddle it up, and that's what happens in the telephone game. Maybe we'll play a joke and we'll just kind of tweak it just a little bit so it doesn't sound the same. No, this was done in a faithful way. The people who wrote these things down, the scribes were very serious about this. In fact, when we were in Israel in 2005 and we visited Qumran over there on the side of the Jordan, we went to the Dead Sea there in Qumran, sits by it. I was interested to learn that the scribes, who they think were the Essenes, I know there's some debate about this, but the Essenes were very meticulous in translating or in copying the Old Testament. And so when they would make a mistake in a manuscript, they would take that and they would roll it up and they would stick it in a particular cave. And so when they discovered these caves, they found out that certain caves were set aside for discarding the bad manuscripts, the bad documents. And they didn't mark something out and then initial it and then, you know, here's this scribe and I'll initial and put my initial here. And this is what we do in medical documents. Medical notes, you can't mark something out or can't erase it. If I make a mistake in one of my notes, I have to put a single line through it, write what I changed, and then initial it. They didn't do this. They just discarded the whole document and restarted the thing all over again. So they were very meticulous about this. They didn't leave mistakes unchanged. They finished the rest of the document. They weren't cavalier about the process. They took it very seriously, as did almost every scribe thereafter. You know, I used to love to play the game of golf. I used to enjoy to go out with my stepdad and we'd play golf when I go to Kansas City or we go to the feast and we play a couple rounds of golf and really had a good time and enjoyed it. It's a very frustrating game because you can shoot par or under par in the first half and then just completely blow it on the second half or vice versa. I don't play so much anymore. In fact, I haven't played for years. Just don't have the time to do it anymore. But I loved the game. It was very enjoyable when I was doing well. But this game of golf, for instance, has been handed down from generation to generation over years and years. This game of golf has gone on for a very long time. Not sure how long, maybe 100 or a couple hundred years. But you know, when I think about the game of golf, it's a gentleman's game, right? It's a game of gentleman play. It's a game that requires discipline to play it. In other words, there are specific rules to play the game. If you want to play golf, this is the way you play. In fact, if you don't play by the rules, you're really not playing golf. And in many respects, the sport is defined by the rules that make up the game. If you completely change it, then you're playing something completely different. You're not playing golf or tennis or checkers, or you're not playing that. You're playing something that you've just made up. Now, what if we went golfing together and you said, you know, well, you really don't know how golf was played 20 generations ago. You really don't know how that was played. In fact, how do you even know that this game is the same game that was played, you know, 150 years ago? How do we know that? We don't know what original golf really was. Maybe this is just some completely different thing. Would that be an assumption that you would immediately make? Well, this isn't the game was played. I don't think you would make that assumption. I wouldn't make that assumption necessarily. Because, as I said, there is a discipline to the game. There's a rule to the game. And when you have this that has been disseminated over the, let's say, decades in different places around the world, somebody just doesn't change the game over here and all of a sudden it's changed everywhere else. No, wherever it disseminates from and it goes out, it's always the same. It's always the same. And so you see this around the country or around the world. You see the golf being played the same because the rules have been passed down and they've been kept intact. Really, the same principle applies to the New Testament. There is a process in place that we can interrogate, if we can call it that. We can interrogate the sources along the way, since so many of them have survived. With the Gospels in particular, we can answer this question about whether this is just legend with a much greater degree of confidence than we could even 12 or 13 years ago, just, you know, over a decade ago. The main question of concern here that we're addressing is, are the gospel accounts really based on eyewitness testimony? Are they really based on eyewitness testimony? Now, the skeptic like Bart Ehrman would say that since the gospels were written outside of the land of which they described the events that they were in, they cannot be eyewitness accounts. He says that they were written miles and miles away by people who had nothing to do with the events that they record. So why should we trust them? We can't trust them. Why should we believe what they say? Now, skeptical scholars and traditional scholars really agree on this thing, in that the Gospels were written many miles away from the land from which the events they record. The origins in Palestine. For example, Mark, we believe, was written in Rome. We believe Luke was written most likely in Antioch, maybe Achaia, maybe Rome, but most likely Antioch. John, for instance, we believe was written in Ephesus. Matthew was most likely written in Judea, the only one. So the skeptic will say this: Well, they were written hundreds of miles away from their lands of origin. So we can't really believe them. So this is what Bart Ehrman says. He says, can we trust them? They have no real connection to the events they recorded. Where then did these anonymous Greek speakers, authors live? Greek speaking authors live? Probably outside of the Palestine, some 35 to 65 years after the event they narrate. Where did they get the information? Now, for us, this is a great question. This is a wonderful question that now we can defend. We can give an apologetic for this question. We don't have to cower and hide from it. We can attack this head on. We can answer them. In fact, the gospel writers were writing outside of the land. It gives us incredible evidence of the validity of the New Testament scriptures and eyewitness testimony. I mean, the fact that they were far away gives us something to investigate. It gives us something forensically, basically, that we can investigate. And I'm going to show you why this is so important that they were outside the land and not inside the land. In other words, the questions that we're going to ask is this. If these writers were outside the land, what did they get right? What did they get wrong? Did they, for instance, get the geography of the area correct? How about the agriculture? What about botany? How about architecture? Did they get the traditions correct? How about burial practices? What about the economics? Did they get the language correct? How about the law? Did they get personal names correct? How about the culture? Did they get all of these things correct? Now, this is a lot of stuff to make up. If you're making up a story, this is a tremendous amount of stuff to try and to make up. Could they construct the story without actually having been there? Well, you know yourselves, if you've never been to a place, right? It's very hard to get the kind of details correct. It's very difficult. And you know, if you live thousands and thousands of miles away from one place and you had no access to the internet and there was no way to snoop on that particular place. I mean, today we can go to Google Maps and you can go to Street View and I can actually see the front of your house. Unless you're out in the country. Can't see that. But I can snoop on many places. I can learn about those things. Couldn't do that back then. You couldn't do that. You had to have eyewitness testimony to be able to come up with the details here. You know, this is really an amazing thing. So the first question we can ask, and I want to ask here, is the question of names. The question of names. What were people called? And do the writers call the characters by the right names? Do they call them by the correct names? Now, at first, this may sound a little strange. You might ask, how can we even know that anyway? How is it possible to know that? It doesn't sound, like this is really going to tell us anything about the authenticity of the New Testament scriptures, about the eyewitness accounts. But really, though, this is quite staggering. And I'm going to show you why. In 2002, a German scholar by the name of Tal Elan did a study that she called Lexicon of Jewish Names in Late Antiquity, Part 1. Now, how's that for a title? That'll make you want to read it. Lexicon of Jewish Names in Late Antiquity, Part 1. She did a comprehensive study of the names that were used by people in Palestine during the time that the Gospels were written. So what she did was she took inscriptions that they had discovered through archaeological finds. She took inscriptions on bone boxes and different writings outside of the New Testament, like the Dead Sea Scrolls and many other things. And she did this exhaustive, comprehensive study, and she studies all of the names that come up, and then she ranks the names to find out what the most popular names were of that time. Now, that per se really doesn't mean a whole lot. But then, Richard Bauckham, he's a professor of the New Testament studies at the University of St. Andrews. He comes along, he takes this study that Elon does. And he pulls this study out 4 years later in 2006, and he compares it with the New Testament. Now, if I were to ask you to go back in history in the U.S. to 1900 to 1940, somewhere around that time, and I were to say to you, can you tell me the top 10 names in the U.S. during that time period? Do you think you could get those right? Might get some of them right. Might get a few of them. Okay. How about Scotland? How about Australia 100 years ago? Would you get those names right? Imagine if I were to say to you, okay, forget 100 years ago. Forget that. How about right now? Could you tell me the top 10 names in the U.S. right now of boys' names? Could you do that? We don't have internet. No. How about 1,000 miles away in Canada? Could you tell me the top 10 male names in Canada right now? Or even England, 1,000 or several thousand miles away. Could you tell me the top male names today? I'm sure you couldn't tell me. I can't tell you either. We so easily can get names wrong in stories. We can so easily get that wrong. And especially in a place that is so distant to us that we don't really know very well. Now, the writers of the New Testament were thousands of miles away in most cases. Ephesus and Antioch, both of them were over 6,000 miles away. Over 6,000 miles away from Jerusalem. Even Rome is over 1,000, about 1,400 miles away. And before 2002, this study had not been completed, hadn't been done. Nothing like it had ever been done before. There was nothing to look at. There was nothing to source for the names in Israel or Palestine in that particular time, in that particular region. So what were people called in Palestinian Jewish antiquity? I'm going to give you the list of the top 10 names. Actually, let me give you 11. Here's the order of the most popular names at that time. Number one is Simon. Number two is Joseph. Number three is Lazarus. Number four is Judas or Judah. No, it's number four, Judas or Judah. If you're writing these down, I'll give you a little bit of space here. Number five is John. Number six is Jesus. Number seven is Ananias. Number eight is Jonathan. Number nine is Matthew. Number 10 is, I think it's Minayan. Not sure how to pronounce that. Number 11 is James. Now, do those names sound familiar to you? Many of them sound very familiar to you. Now, if you take the top nine names, for instance, the top nine, we're going to skip this number 10, which I don't know that name, but of these Jewish Palestinian male names, and we put them together, outside of the New Testament in this study, they account for approximately 41% of all name usage in that time. Inside the New Testament, they account for 40% of all name usage inside the New Testament. In other words, what does this mean? It means the gospel writers got it dead on. They didn't guess about this, obviously, but they were right on topic here. And this is a pattern that shows up over four writers, over five books, if we count Acts, and those four writers writing five books, both individually and corporately, show the same pattern. They reflect that pattern. Now, here's something else that makes this even more astounding than it really already is. If you go over to Egypt during this time period, and you look at the top names in Egypt in a Jewish community, you find something that's interesting. Richard Bauckham did this investigation of Jewish names given to people in Egypt at the same time period. What do you think the names of the Jews were approximately 250 miles away, 200, 250 miles away? Relatively close. Well, here's what the most common names were in Egypt at that time. Number one was Lazarus. Number two was Sabbateus. Number three was Joseph. Number four was Dosephius. Number five was Pappus. Number six was Tolnaeus. And number seven was Samuel. And I don't have the rest of them. But you can see that these names are largely different. Just a few hundred miles away, these are not the names that we see for the most part in the New Testament. A couple of them are. So over a matter of a relatively short distance, the names that people were called, even in a Jewish community, are different from what they were called in the Palestine Jewish community. And the gospel writers, witnessing sometimes thousands of miles away, are spot on. Why? Because it's not fake. They didn't make it up. They didn't draw upon their own narrative for their own agenda. Now, some may say this is a hoax. This is some elaborate hoax. They looked into it and somehow they investigated it and they fixed it. But frankly, there's just, it's insanity to suggest such a thing, to think that you could somehow fix this. No, this is an amazingly strong supporting evidence that the gospel writers writing outside of the land of origin were writing based on eyewitness testimony. You know what is most amazing about this, though? You know what the most amazing thing about this is? Not just that they got the names correct, but that they got the characteristics of the names correct, and they got the proportions of the names correct. It's staggering when you think about it, when you look at it from a skeptical point of view. Now, when Carol and I were choosing names for our children, I didn't want to have popular names for our kids. I didn't want to pick names that were very popular at that time. I said, you know, if they're sitting in a classroom in school and teacher asks a question and they all have their hands raised up and they all say, or she says, Aiden, and then eight of them say yes. I didn't really want something like that to happen where you have a ton of these kids around. Actually, Aiden's been the most popular name, I think, for 7 years in a row until it's just been replaced by Liam, I think, for the last 2 years. So there are very popular names that run throughout history. You know, I didn't want him to have an identity crisis. Who am I? I wanted him to be unique. I wanted him to be different, a little bit different. So imagine if you could in the first century and you go out into the street and you say, Simon! How many Simons are going to come running? You'd have a lot of them out there, a fairly high number who are going to say, yes, yes, what did you need? So what do the gospel writers know? Well, they know intuitively from the eyewitnesses that many of the names, including Simon, actually need qualifiers. They need qualifiers to distinguish them from another Simon. Jesus, for instance, has two Simon disciples. One is Simon Peter, and the other is Simon the Zealot. Jesus also had dinner with Simon the leper. There was also Simon the Cyrene who carried the cross, and Simon Peter stayed in Acts with Simon the Tanner. So there's qualifiers that we see throughout the New Testament in many places to try and make a distinction of a particular name that was popular at the time. And Simon, of course, being number one, there's going to be distinction. Now, what about Mary? Mary, we didn't go over that, but Mary's a very popular female name, very, very popular at that time. And we see, for instance, we see Mary distinguished as Mary, the mother of Jesus. We see Mary Magdalene. We see Mary of Bethany. We have Mary, the mother of John Mark. Mary, the mother of Joseph. Mary of Rome. We have Mary, the wife of Clopas, and there are others. So we have a lot of distinction on names. I'd like you to turn to Matthew chapter 10 now. Matthew chapter 10, we have a list of the disciples here that Matthew writes out for us. Now, remember, the gospel writers had not done any research. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have some outside source to or research to know this. They had no way of getting background or information to concoct these stories. They just knew the reality of the eyewitness accounts. What we see the gospel writers doing is that when names are incredibly popular, they disambiguate that name by giving it a qualifier. And where names are incredibly popular, they have to qualify it. Where the names aren't incredibly popular, they don't put a qualifier with it. They just leave the name as it is because the names weren't common. So they would not have, you know, they wouldn't have to need to, have no need to distinguish these names because they were, people kind of knew who the individual was. But in Matthew chapter 10, it says, and he called unto himself his disciples, and he gave them power against unclean spirits and cast them out to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease. In verse 2, it says, now the names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother. James, the son of Zebedee, John his brother. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the publican. James, son of Alphaeus, Lebbeus, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot. So look at this again. Simon, the first one, okay? Simon, who ranks number one, is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother. James, who ranks number 11 on the list of popular names, a high-ranking name, is qualified by saying he's the son of Zebedee. John, who ranks fifth on the most popular names, is his brother. Philip comes in at 61st popular name on the list, and he needs no qualifier. Bartholomew, who is 50th on the list, again, needs no qualifier either. Thomas doesn't even appear in the top 100, so no qualifier is needed. I don't imagine there were many twins at that time. And Thomas means twin. So he doesn't need a qualifier. Matthew comes in at number 9 on the most popular list, so he's high ranking, and he's called the tax collector. James is 11th on the list, and he's called the son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus is 39th place, and he has a low ranking, relatively low. Really, there's no qualifier, but it does say, Lebbeus. He does associate it with that. So he's sort of in that limbo middle land. Simon, again, the number one name is called the Canaanite or the Cananean. And then Judas is the fourth most popular name, and he's given the qualifier of Iscariot, the one who betrayed Christ. Now, how could the gospel writers have known this? How could they have known that they needed qualifiers? Because they were reporting from actual eyewitness testimony, even though many of them were writing thousands of miles away from the events that they were recording. They write with accuracy that could only be tested, frankly, 12 years ago. We could only test this 12 years ago. There's another piece of evidence that goes right along with this. These qualifiers also happen when speech is reported in the Gospels, when actual quotations are used. And this goes directly to the question of whether the writers knew what happened. Were the Gospels based on eyewitness accounts? We see direct speech being recorded, actual dialogue. Look in Matthew chapter 14. Look down at Matthew chapter 14 and verse 1. It says, at the time, Herod the Tetrarch heard of the fame of Jesus. In verse 2, and said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and therefore mighty works do show forth themselves in him. Now, Herod wants to say that Jesus is John the Baptist come back from the dead. But he can't just say this to his servant. In other words, he can't just say this is John with no qualifier come back from the dead. There were thousands of Johns. How would he know who he's talking about? Remember, John is a very popular name. So when Herod says to his servants, this is John, he says, this is John the Baptist come back from the dead, because he had to distinguish which John he was talking about. But after Herod said, this is John the Baptist, the narrator telling the story can continue just talking about John, which they do. And if you read down through there, it just says John. And Herod said, had laid hold on John and bound him and put him in prison. Verse 4, for John said to him. So he just goes on talking about it. He set the context. He knows who we're talking about. But then as we look down in verse 8, this is one of the more gory stories of the Bible that we see here. But we see that Herodias, his daughter, has asked for John's head on a platter. Now remember, the writer has just been saying, John. We know it's John the Baptist. Herod had said it. Herod already said it. But when her speech is reported of what she actually said, she specifies. She would have known there were hundreds of Johns as well, even in the palace possibly. But she says, I want the head of John the Baptist on a platter. Now, if you're just narrating the story, you wouldn't actually need to include the detail. You know which John it is, but the author is reporting direct speech, and the dialogue specifies when it's necessary, and this happens all over the New Testament. This is just one example. We have a second test, not just what people were called, but what was the main character called in the Gospels? And these tests were developed by a man at Tyndale House called Pete Williams, by the way. Pete Williams had come up with these tests. But what is the main character called? Now, in the four Gospels, the main character is referred to as Jesus. That's what he's referred to. But in outside Gospels, in other Gospels that were written making claims, they use different wording. For instance, there's the Gospel of Philip that was written about 150 years after the time of Jesus. And the Gospel of Philip is, again, it's written outside of the land of origin, just like the New Testament Gospels were, way after the events, though. And it calls the main character not Jesus, but Christ. That's what the main character is called. There's another Gospel, I don't have this written down, but I'm pretty sure that the Gospel of Philip also thinks that Nazareth is, make sure that this is not something else. Yeah, thinks that Nazareth is Jesus' middle name, not a town. I could be wrong about that. I might come up with something here later, but let me go on here, because if we look at the Gospel of Peter, for instance, it doesn't call him Christ or Jesus. It calls him Lord. It calls him Lord. The Gospel of Mary calls him Savior. Calls him Savior. In later writings, the name drops out altogether. Names are the first thing that drop out. Have you ever watched a movie, for instance? And it was a great movie, or maybe it was a TV show, and the plot was so riveting and so amazing. And when you retell it to someone, you can tell the plot wonderfully. You can explain all the details to them, but you just can't remember the name of the characters. Well, that's what happens over time. The names of the main characters get changed, or they drop out altogether. Names very quickly go away. And we see this with Gospels that were written much later after these events. So Jesus, the main character, is what he is referred to in all of the New Testament Gospels. We have another test that we can look at, and that is the test of geography. The test of geography. Do the authors know the place that they're describing? Do they know it? Well, people's knowledge of geography can be very questionable at times, especially in places that they don't live in, places that they've never visited. Even if you have visited a place, I've been to Pittsburgh, I think, two or three times, and driven around there a little bit, gone downtown several times. But man, I don't think I could tell you much about Pittsburgh. Not many details, certainly. And even if I were able to snoop on the internet like I can today and just try and scour the city, I'm not going to tell you all the details of the together and the whole socioeconomic congealing of the city. I can't tell you all that stuff. And remember, in the ancient world, there wasn't any internet. There was no particular specific maps. Your knowledge of that place that you're writing about is going to be questionable unless you have eyewitness testimony or you have been there yourself to know this. Gospel writers, if they had not lived in Palestine or had not had eyewitness accounts, their knowledge could not be what it would be to write the Gospels. In the Gospels, the most commonly mentioned place is Jerusalem. There are 66 references to the capital city. The next city that is mentioned, the second most, is Nazareth. Nazareth. There are 21 references to Nazareth where Jesus grew up. These are not the only places mentioned in the Bible, though, in the New Testament's Gospels. There is places like Capernaum mentioned 16 times. There are places like Bethany, Bethlehem, Bethsaida, Jericho, Sidon, Tyre, Enon, Bethpage, Caesarea Philippi, Cana, Chorazin. You know, these are tiny. Some of these are tiny villages that are mentioned in the Gospels. And many of these places, for instance, like Bethpage, wouldn't even be on a Roman map. They wouldn't even show up. These are tiny villages. But they don't just know the names of the places, the gospel writers don't. They don't just know that alone. They also know things about them. For instance, they know that places like Capernaum are next to the sea. They know traveling times between these towns. You know, if we, for instance, if we compare this to the apocryphal gospels, which were written much later by people who really have no direct connection, no direct contact, no eyewitness testimony of the events they're describing. When we look at those, the differences between these two are staggering. These later apocryphal books versus the New Testament gospels. The four gospels mentions 12 to 14 towns each, a total of 23 places. The Gospel of Philip mentions two. Jerusalem and Nazareth. And this is where I was remembering this. And Nazareth, it says, is Jesus' middle name. Doesn't even know it's a place or a town. The Gospel of Peter mentions one town, Jerusalem. And that's it. And the other second and third century Gospels mention no specific places whatsoever. None. That's what happens when people make up stories. They forget the details. They don't know the details. A long time after it's happened, the details fall out. So what if the four Gospels are actually telling us what really happened? You know, they mention the places naturally, not in some intrusive way, because these are historical accounts written by real people about a real time and a real place, about real events that occurred. And finally, just quickly, there's the test of botany and other details. In the story of Zacchaeus, for instance, we have the example that we read about the sycamore fig tree in Jericho, written about by Luke. Are there really sycamore fig trees in Jericho? Really? Yes, there happens to be sycamore fig trees in Jericho. Amazing. How did he know it? Because he had eyewitness accounts, eyewitness testimony to what was there. This is the sort of thing that people would know if they've been to a place. And the gospel writers get it right. They get it all right. They get the names right. They get the plants right. They get the geography right. They get the shapes and the sizes of houses right. They get the coins right. They get the shape of the temple correct. They get all of the details correct. You know, there are so many opportunities that these writers could go wrong on. So many opportunities they could have just fallen off on when they were talking about culture, and yet they don't. They get every detail correct. They could have fallen down on local details, and yet consistently, every single time, they were correct. And even when we didn't believe them in let's say, in archaeological terms, there's always something that comes up later in archaeology that says, you know what? They were right after all. They get it all correct. And the evidence points to eyewitness testimony recorded and preserved and passed down to us today in truly a staggering way. No matter what the challenges are thrown, no matter what challenges are thrown at the validity of the scriptures, God always provides an answer to the skeptic. He always has an answer for them. Brethren, I know you did not need to hear this sermon today to try to convince you that the New Testament scriptures are valid. I know that you all believe that they're valid. Otherwise, we would not be sitting here. I don't need to support your belief with that. I think that it can support your faith. I think that it can buoy it. It can uphold it to know that these things match up with what history is finding. Even if it didn't, it doesn't mean it would change anything. But what it does for us is it can sustain our faith, and it is also an apologetic for anyone that may have a question about our faith. And if we're told to give an answer back, that is an apologia, to someone who has questions, these are answers that we can give back to them. If someone is questioning or wondering about some of these things, these are very, very powerful illustrations for these people. It really is a wonderful thing And despite living in this current age of technology and the lack of faith and the lack of belief that we have, despite all the advancements that we have in archaeology, our faith stands strong in the Scriptures. And God allows us to defend our faith in ways that are oftentimes unexpected. It's truly a wonderful thing that God has given us this wonderful book, the Bible. It's a very special thing. It has all the answers that pertain to life and pertain to godliness, as Peter says. Hope you all have a great Sabbath.